Food Talk with Mike Colomeco has been brought to you by Cento, Calavita, and Wines of Portugal.
Hi, this is Celia Cutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. You're listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network on this blustery November day. It's cold. New York got cold this week. I guess the whole country got cold. Could be worse. We could be in Buffalo sitting in our car for 2 days. Man, that must suck. Anyway, one big shout out to a couple restaurants I've been hitting the last few weeks in Brooklyn. Yeah, I discovered that if you take the F train from the Brooklyn-bound platform, which I never do, it takes you to Brooklyn. So it's easy. It's easier for me to get to Carroll Street as it is to get to 14th Street, and just as fast. And in doing so, I find myself in Carroll Garden and tried two restaurants the last couple of weeks. Same owners, chef owner, both chef-driven chef owners. One is Dover. It's their newer one. I was there a couple of weeks ago, blown away. Amazing tasting menu. Really serious chops. And I was at Battersby on Monday night, and it was fantastic, just great. Maybe it was Tuesday night. I get my nights confused this week, but these guys are great. So, I mean, the whole Brooklyn restaurant scene is really interesting. So much talent out here. Some of it's hit or miss to me. You know, it's kind of a youth-driven scene, so it kind of has to grow up. But there's just so much talent, and then I hit two places like this where I'm like, you know what? In any borough, in anywhere in Manhattan, this would be a restaurant I'd go to. These guys are great. So congrats to those boys. I had my first visit to Michael White's I guess it's, you'd call it his Italian steakhouse down on Spring Street, Costada, this week. That was Monday night's dinner. It's great. Expensive, but great. Spring, right off of 6th Avenue. I don't know what neighborhood it is. It's not exactly Soho. It's kind of a funny location, kind of tucked up against Varick in that part of town. But used to be Fiamma for years, three-story building. And Risto is the sommelier there, and Risto just did an amazing wine pairing for us. I was with a couple of wine friends, and he was cool because he came to the table and he wouldn't show us the bottles, and he'd pour it, and he kind of made us think and guess, and thank God there was three of us, because let me tell you, when you have three good palates that can get together on a blind tasting, it's so much easier than wandering that terrain alone. So we kind of got the first one close to right and knew it was going to be Italian, Southern Italian, volcanic. We went to Sicily. Bingo. It was a white Etna wine. White wine from Mount Etna. It was great. Second one was another funky one from Piedmont that we loved that was white, that we kind of were close. And the third one was a Nebbiolo that we guessed the varietal. Close enough. So speaking of wine, and I want to get into it today, because we got a bunch of guests, three actually. My first one is Brian Friedman, who I've traveled with on several occasions with to Portugal. One time just on a press trip. Actually, no, excuse me. Once to Portugal, and most recently this past September to the Alto Adige. Then we've got guests in from Feastly, which is this crazy website. It's kind of like Airbnb for dining out. I don't get it. His name is Noah Koresh. He's going to try and talk me into why anyone would want to do this. But people are doing it. So it's like, you know, what do I know? I'm old. I go to restaurants and I make reservations. And my last guy is going to be Josh Bloom, who makes artisanal simple syrups, an interesting space to fill in. But let's take Brian. Brian, are you there?
I am here.
Brian Friedman. First of all, good luck on the marathon next Sunday in Philadelphia.
Yeah, thank you. I actually have a whole lineup of wine set for once I've survived this thing as a reward.
Yeah, it's a kind of the post. The post is funny. You'll be the next day, and even later that day, walking downstairs is going to be really a challenge. Your quads are going to be fried. But good luck. I know you've been training. You're just about from South Africa. How was that?
South Africa was amazing. It was everything I was hoping for times 1,000. It was great.
We'll have to discuss that when we're not on business time. We'll do that over a glass of wine or a beer or something. So let's talk about you and I were just in the Alto Adige. We did a wine trip together in Portugal, so we kind of know each other's palates. You have some wines you want to talk about today out of Italy, and let's just start out with the, I don't know how to pronounce it, Collina di Ciliegi. It's from the Veneto. It's an Amarone. Let's talk about Amarone specifically, the grapes. So we have Corvina, Rondinella, Molinara, and we have this thing called Pesito. Describe to us how Amarones are made.
Yeah, so this is interesting. So this wine, the Collina dei Ciliegi, is part of the IW&SP, the Italian Wine and Style Promotion Consortium. It's 12 wineries based in 5 regions, Piedmont, Veneto, Tuscany, Marche, and Umbria. And they're sort of highlighting not just the beauty of the wines, but the lifestyle, the places themselves. And I think Amarone, this one in particular, is a great place to start. I'm glad you did. So, you know, most wines, you harvest the grapes, you crush them, you ferment the juice, and you have your wine. Obviously, it's just slightly more complicated than that, but more or less that's the order of the process. When you're making Amarone, you pick the grapes, and then they're laid out and dried. And in this case, these grapes are dried for like 4 months after the harvest, and they're losing a minimum of 40% of their weight. So what happens then is by the time you actually crush the grapes to get the juice out of them, the sugars are more concentrated, the nature of the skins has changed, and you get these amazing, rich, concentrated, deep, complex flavors that you just can't get in any other style of winemaking.
They're huge. They're huge. And it's... Now, you, I mean, I'm not going to ask you this question like I need a yes or no answer, but it seems to me that actually Amarone production has reduced over the last 15 to 20 years. Is that true, or has it stayed the same?
Yeah, I'm not sure if the production has reduced so much as maybe we're seeing a little bit less of it on this side of the Atlantic.
Okay.
But you know, these days I'm actually noticing a real uptick in high-quality Amarone. I think, you know, the problem was for a long time that there were some Amarones out there that were, you know, hugely alcoholic, and
right,
all you were tasting was the winemaking as opposed to the terroir. This one, for example, you're still tasting the terroir. You're still tasting this really unique place where it's from, and I think that makes it a lot more, let's say, user-friendly at the table.
Thank you. Thanks. As one of my criticisms, say, in the aughts in the late 90s, whenever I went to Amarone tastings when I had them in New York, was, what am I going to pair this with? I mean, besides a wild boar stew, I mean, this is going to crush everything on the table. It is just too big, it's too concentrated, it's too dense, it's too alcoholic. But, so, that's great. Now, can I find these wines in the city? Can I find them in the States?
So actually, these wines, I just helped them taste them in Red Hook. You were talking about Carroll Street. That's where I took the subway to. They're currently hoping to find importers in the States, and I think this is really interesting that these are wines that are a unique style. They're beautifully expressive. I think there's a big push right now to sort of expand the range that people have access to. But you can certainly find wines of this style in the city, no question.
Okay, let's talk about another grape that's entirely different. This... So the Fungaro Spumanti, is it Durello? Purello? Describe this wine to me. Talk to me about it.
Yeah, so this is fun because the wine geeks can kind of wrap their arms around this from a theoretical standpoint, but the people who just love drinking wine can really, you know, sink their teeth and palates into it once they get it in the glass. Durella is an indigenous grape of the Veneto region, and it has uniquely high acid levels, which makes it really well suited for sparkling wines in this style.
That's why the wine geeks like it, because it's high acid, brisk, mineral-driven, clean.
Yeah, and the wine geeks also like grapes that people aren't familiar with.
Yeah, Durello.
That's exactly it, you know. I know a grape from the middle of Hungary that you've never had before. I'm cooler than you. You know, but what's interesting with this wine is I think there's a sense of both excitement and almost a sense of comfort in the glass. I mean, they're aging this on the lees for 30 months. I mean, there are sparkling wines from all over the planet that aren't giving it 30 months of lees aging. So you're getting this amazing sense of yeastiness and bread and bakery notes and this beautiful sort of bitterness at the end that, you know, it makes you want to take another bite of food and another drink of the wine.
Yeah, and I wish that we talked about champagne on the last couple of weeks in the show, and I wish people would drink these sparkling wines with meals instead of, you know, just thinking that it's a before-dinner toast kind of thing or an aperitif. These, I mean, you think about the grape varietals, think about, like, what you're talking about, 30 months on lees. This is a wine that wants food while you're drinking it, and I think great champagnes, the sparkling wines from the Birada in Portugal are the same method champagne was, just drink them with food. Let's go to a light wine that's interesting. I can't say... Tell me about this Moscato from Piedmont.
All right. So, look, there are two kinds of Moscato in the world. There's the Moscato that is sweet and simple, and that's about it. And then there's this kind of Moscato from Il Bottolo. This is a Moscato. It's 100% Moscato. It's hand-harvested, 25-year-old average age of the vines. So you're really getting a sense of complexity here that most people aren't necessarily expecting in Moscato d'Asti. So you're getting those floral notes, honey, apricot, peaches, but it's not overly sweet or candied. So this actually, I think, is amazing with spicier foods, with sort of more aromatic foods. This also is begging for, you know, accompaniment at the table.
All right. Last but not least, and we're going to go back to slightly heavy, I'm guessing. I haven't tasted any of these, and I wish you'd send me some bottles, but that's not going to happen. Tell me about this Piedmont blend. So we're in the Piedmont again, so we're kind of north central, and now we're going to two non-indigenous varietals, Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the Colimanora Barchetta, it's a blend of Cab Sauvignon and Merlot. And I think what makes this so exciting for me is when most of us think of Piedmont, we're thinking Nebbiolo, yep. Barbera, Dolcetto. Yep. Maybe if we're going white, we'll go with like a Langhe or a Nace. But we don't necessarily think of the international varietals doing well there, and they do. When they are given a great south-southwest exposure on a good vineyard like these are, you can really get some interesting expressions of these grapes. In this case, they're seeing 8 months in oak barrique. So it's sort of splitting the difference between, using the international grape varieties and some of that oak, but also expressing the incredibly unique terroir of this part of Piedmont. And I think that's an interesting direction that we're probably going to see a little bit more of coming out of Italy in coming years.
And you talk about southern. It's so interesting how, I mean, we've traveled before, how slope and elevation and exposure to sunlight during the day affects wine. Why do you think that matters, that southern exposure for these wines?
Well, I mean, look, Piedmont is not necessarily Sicily, right? I mean, you're not getting 1,000 hours of sunlight every day. So if you can, that would be a long day. But if you can maximize the sun exposure at the proper parts of the day, you're going to coax greater ripeness out of these grapes during the day. You're still going to get those nice cool nights, so you're going to maintain that sense of acidity. And it's going to allow you to find that balance between a wine that's going to have a sense of richness and depth, but at the same time, because of those cooler nights, it's never going to become sort of plodding and heavy-handed. It's still going to remain, fresh on the palate.
All right, we'll switch gears for one second. I have to ask you, what was your biggest surprise in your recent trip back from South Africa? What was your biggest eye-opener? That oh my God moment when you were there. What did you taste that just shocked you?
I got to tell you, I went there like most wine people, thinking I'm going to have a ton of Chenin Blanc, a ton of Pinotage, and I had some wonderful ones, no question, some of the best in the world. But I had some amazing Sauvignon Blancs. The Sauvignon Blancs, they're sort of halfway between that Loire Valley style, great minerality, but also a nice sense of ripeness and richness like you might get in New Zealand.
Yeah.
An incredible Shiraz. I had one Shiraz, I forget the producer off the top of my head, but it was almost like if an Australian Shiraz and a Northern Rhone Syrah had a baby. This is what it was. It was ripe blackberry fruit and bacon, and it was perfect.
Dang, gee. Sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's an amazing place.
Brian Friedman is a Philadelphia-based wine consultant, wine expert, travels, writes about wine. You could read some of his writing, John Mariani's newsletter, which is great. You had a great little piece a couple of weeks ago on, you had told me about it, so it was, I heard, already heard the story, but you had spent nearly a month, I guess, in June or July with your family off the coast of Bari, Italy.
Yeah, we were in Puglia. We rented the vacation house of a Rome-based colleague of mine who works for the Marco Polo Experience, Valentino Villone. He works with Patrizia Marine, and I snagged his family's summer house for a month.
I spend my summers in Cape May, which is a really beautiful beach. I love it there, and I looked at your pictures, and I thought, damn, I'm never jealous in the summer, but you might have had me for a month there.
Yeah, I'm ready to go back. I'm ready to go back like yesterday.
Yeah, I know, with this weather. I'm sure Philly's the same thing as it is in New York. I'm already planning getting out of here at some point, because if it stays this cold for the next 90 to 120 days, goodbye. Hey, Brian, thank you so much. Italian wines. Where else can they find? So you write for Mariani's newsletter. Where else can people find what you do?
Oh, man. So I'm the editor-in-chief of Drink Me Magazine, so drinkmemag.com. We're doing some really exciting things, wine, beer, spirits, travel, food. I'm the restaurant critic for Philadelphia Weekly, Mariani's Virtual Gourmet, and Philadelphia Style. You know, my wife says if I have a chance to you know, drink early in the morning and write about it, I'll take that job.
Hey, that's my job. Brian Friedman, be well. Good luck on the marathon this week. Have fun. The weather looks to be good. It's going to be nice and cool. It'll keep you going. Stay hydrated. You know the drill. You've done all your training. You've done your 20s. Good luck. Email me when you get time next week. Just let me know how it went.
All right, will do. It was great talking to you.
Thank you. Folks, listening to Mike Kalameko's Food Talk on the Heritage Radio Network. We've got a couple of more guests coming up. We're going to take a quick spot right now. We'll see who's in studio because there's traffic issues and people coming in from Brooklyn. So it's either going to be Josh Bloom of Purely Simple Syrup or Noah Koresh, if he's managed to get here from wherever he was coming from, in Kings County to this part of Kings County, which is never easy. But we'll be back in a couple of minutes after a spot, and you'll hear more of Mike Kalameko's Food Talk then. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, and these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece, and that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We canned Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, handpick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey, folks. Mike Kalameko here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants, wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, port is the birthplace of ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. Like, I keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them are growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you spot by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
Hi, I'm Reggie Watts, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, you're back with Mike Colomeco, and you are listening to HeritageRadio.org. And, for interest or full disclosure, I just inhaled a half a pizza. That's right. In that break, we ate. It's one of the bonuses here at Heritage is you get to eat Roberta's pizza, should you choose. I don't know which one I just had, but it was like covered with kale and mushrooms and chilies, Calabrian chilies, I think. And it's bloody good. All right. So, let's segue. My guest is Noah Koresh, who's the founder, CEO, creative brains behind. Is that all good? Okay. Behind something called Feastly, which is a supper club at home. Now, you're going to have to, Noah, welcome, by the way.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and he's just in from San Francisco. He flew in the red eye last night, got to New York at 8 in the morning, so I don't know when he slept last, but he's a young man, and you guys can do that kind of stuff better than I can. Tell me about Feastly. When the idea came to be, and why?
Yeah. So just to kind of give everyone understanding what Feastly is. So We're a P2P, which means peer-to-peer marketplace that allows any chef, supper club host, pop-up chef, home cook to be able to offer and serve meals to any hungry eater. And essentially what that means is we built a platform that enables people to post their meals on it. So whether that's a Malaysian meal or a French meal or something more around dietary lifestyle, so a macrobiotic, they can put up the number of seats, the cost of it, and the date and time and location, and people will come on our site and see all the different meals, and they'll book it either for themselves alone or maybe for a group of people.
And you do this, and how many cities is this currently live in?
Yeah, so we're active in New York, D.C., and San Francisco. We have had meals that have happened in all 50 states and in a number of countries around the world, but we're not fully active there. It's a bit more of a utility. And essentially, what we're doing is unlocking all of this latent or unused or underutilized talent that exists all over the world, and especially here in the U.S., and empowering these chefs and cooks to be able to offer and serve those meals to whoever it is. So we're really excited about kind of rethinking what dining is. I think since about the 1700s, we've had the same model. And we're
It's called restaurants.
Exactly. And that's
been my whole life. Wait a minute. Hold on. Put on the brakes, man. It's been working up until now. We've had a good run of 300 plus years.
We have. And I think a number of things have been happening over even just this last few decades that have totally changed how we need to think about what eating is and how we connect around food and what we know about food and how it's prepared and kind of even how we are paying for it or just interacting with it.
What gave you the idea to do this? I mean, so Airbnb is kind of a new-ish thing where, I mean, I'm not saying it's a similar space, but it kind of blew up the idea that, hotels or traditional bed and breakfasts used to be places where people stayed. Now,
exactly. People
are opening up their homes saying, hey, I've got an apartment in Paris or I've got extra space in my pad in New York. If you're coming, I'm not so creepy. Here's my review site. For X amount of night, you can crash in my place.
That's exactly right. So all of this is, there are a number of different terms. We'll just call it the share economy. And that's taking underutilized assets and skill sets and basically utilizing them in ways that could never be done before on a mass scale because of technology. So kind of where this idea got founded, and I think you can look at it as what Airbnb has done for bedrooms, we're doing for kitchens. I think that's an apt analogy. And so my background has always been in kind of food tech and community. So I have been big into food. I've been an eater since I was young. Obviously, we all have to eat. But like my parents, you know, they were taking me to sushi restaurants in the late 80s, which was kind of a radical thing back then. And I used to sit and watch Jan Kin Cook and Julia Child on PBS before there was ever a Food Network. And I went to culinary schools kind of in the summer and things like that. But I never, as a job professionally, worked in the restaurant. I did apprentice at some French restaurants. And when I was living in the Middle East, I was working for a tech startup. And I was a little bit, not bored, but I just, there was just no good Mexican food there. So two of my friends, we started a Mexican pop-up stand on the street. So we made everything from scratch. We brought some stuff in from the U.S. and just started hawking tacos on the street.
Where?
In Tel Aviv.
Hysterical.
And that was all kind of social media driven and just like networks. And it was amazing. We started getting some catering gigs and things like that. So I really saw what it was like to be a food entrepreneur from that angle. After my time out there, our startup, we raised a bunch of money, and then the crash of 2008 came and kind of everything disintegrated, and I came back to the U.S., and while I was working for some other tech startups, I was a little bored, and some buddies of mine, again, we were just like, hey, let's start a cafe in Washington, D.C. D.C. doesn't have a big cafe culture at that time, and still I wouldn't say it's as great. It's grown a lot since then, but it's not like San Francisco or New York or Paris, and we didn't have a lot of money. And so we just said, hey, let's rethink this. So we went to a bar that was closed during the day, and we said, hey, we're going to put a cafe in here. So we really kind of hacked the system in that we didn't have to deal with a lot of licensing, a lot of build-out costs, really.
Yeah, I know what you did. That's classic, right? It was like, fuck that. Let's just... Thanks, guys. We're just walking in. We'll be in at 6 a.m. We'll be out by 4:15.
Exactly. So we're from 7 to 4, and they're open from 5 to whenever it closes. And it's been an amazing symbiotic relationship, and it's called the Blind Dog Cafe. Everything we make is from scratch, is homemade there, and both are kind of the meats, as well as we have a big bakery, some of the best chocolate chip cookies I've ever had. But I really saw what it was like to be involved in a brick and mortar. So it was just another evolution of it.
Ben Leventhal did something a while back called Kitchen Surfer. Do you know it?
Kitchen Surfing, yeah.
What's that about?
So
I'm asking you about Ben, so sorry about to bring. Not that Benny's anyone to shill for him, but yeah, what's that concept?
No problem. It's a little bit different.
Okay.
So
professional chefs who are like
professional
in between gigs.
It's basically like a lookbook for cooks. Hmm. And if you're having a private event, you can go on there and ask them to basically come to your home and cater the event. Ours is very different. You know, it's not a passive experience. For our chefs, they're saying, you know, they're really a catalyst for their own destiny. They're saying, hey, I'm doing this thing. This is the price. Come over. As opposed to waiting around hoping somebody picks you.
How do you vet? It's curious. I mean, I went to the site. I looked at it, and the New York site anyway. And there were familiar faces. There's the guy... Lucas Martin, who seems to love everything meaty. There's the, I guess it's brother and sister, a couple, Marco and Dahlia. So how do you vet the talent that you're allowing to shine on your platform? Yeah.
Well, before I tell you that, I'm going to tell you where Afisa came from. I'm just giving you the background of myself.
Okay, keep going.
Like why I'm doing this. So after that cafe opened, I went on a trip to Guatemala with my girlfriend. And... have you been to Guatemala?
No, but I remember the story. I've read this or I've heard
okay,
it.
Okay, well, I'll kind of let your audience know the story around it. And so when we were there, you know, for us, we love to eat as locally as possible. It's how we understand culture. It's one of the big reasons why we travel. And a weird thing happened. We couldn't find any Guatemalan food.
In Guatemala?
In Guatemala.
Right.
Most bizarre occurrence that's happened to me. And so I told my girlfriend, listen, I don't care what happens. We're going to find some. So we went on a two-hour search to the markets, street, anywhere you'd think to go find food from a country. And nothing was there. We couldn't find anything. A lot of it was just really poor touristy restaurants. And so on our way back, just kind of dejected, we randomly came across a young avocado seller, and we just asked him, hey, my girlfriend speaks fluent Spanish. Do you know where we can find some Guatemalan food? And he must have been like 11. He looked up at us with these big eyes, and a smile came on his face. He was like, yeah, my mom's house.
Right.
We're like, awesome. So crazy serendipity. We follow him back to his home. swings open the door, and there she was, like, making this epic meal. And as those smells hit my nose, I was just like, this is magic. And when I was with her and we were in their home, a few things came across my mind. One was I felt bad for everyone eating at those really poor touristy restaurants. The other was like, why was this so hard for me to find and for her to be able to showcase? And that was really the seed of what we're doing at Feastly, which is unlocking and empowering all these chefs out there who might not want to open up a restaurant or food truck, or who excuse me, who don't have necessarily some of those skill sets, and be able to showcase what they can do, for them to be able to build their brand, maybe make some extra money, and meet people.
I'll go back to my last question. So how do you vet the talent?
Yeah. So
I approach you and I say, hey, my name's Tony and I make Italian food. And I live in Bensonhurst and I do have my grandmother's meatball recipe. And you're like, okay, but Tony, you have to show me A, B, C, D.
Yeah. So we have a pretty rigorous vetting process. We have thousands of folks who want to cook. We only accept a very small percentage of those, in the single digits. And that vetting process consists of, first, they come through an online form where we really understand their background. That moves into other things like them submitting menus as well as photos, and then it moves into an actual video call with them. And then we have a creative services team that they work with, and then we even, all the way up to even tasting of food and kind of visiting where they want to host. So we want to make sure that there's a certain standard that we allow onto the platform. At the same time, even beyond that, let's say they come on, the community is also another kind of arbiter in terms of the quality. So they, after a meal, they leave open reviews that everyone can see, both quantitative and qualitative. So you can see, I'm sure, as you saw, like, you know, if something's not good, it will be notified by the community, and no one would probably book with them again. Fortunately, that really hasn't happened, because I think we do such a great job vetting. And the other thing that we do is we just launched a $1 million cook protection program.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, that kind of leapt out at me, where you have insurance.
Yeah. So that means that any cook who posts on our site and has a meal in their home will be protected up to $1 million. So if someone gets sick or someone gets hurt or something like that, that there's a Fortune 500 insurance company. We built this very special product. They don't need to do anything to get it. Just by posting, you're qualified for it.
Which is interesting, because as I read this, I'm an old guy, and I grew up in the restaurant business, so I went to cooking school, and I worked in restaurants, and I apprenticed and worked up from line cook to potato peeler to pot washer to sous chef to executive chef to restaurant owner, blah, blah, blah. And I'm looking at this, and it's like the whole Airbnb thing. I'm like, you know, when I travel, I really like my anonymity, and I really like the idea of a hotel and a locked door and my own fucking – I don't need fancy. But I like my space. Yep. I never stayed in bed and breakfast for that reason. I don't have breakfast with five people I don't know and act nice in the morning to strangers. I don't want to be thinking about who was there before, after, or the creepy hallway stuff. But I look at what you're doing, and then I think of something like Uber, which is kind of an interesting, not exactly the same thing. But so Uber unlocks people that say, hey, I've got a license and I've got a clean record and I can do this thing that taxis normally did. But the question with Uber was, and now that we're sort of peeling the onion, is, well, who are these people? Are they insured? What do they do? So talk about this. So we have the $1 million insurance, and then – and kind of like Airbnb also, they have reviews too. So if there's a creepy guy that girls have stayed at and had a shitty experience, supposedly that comes up. But how do you wrestle with that? How do you give that sense? Because as an older person, I'm thinking, I don't know if I really want to go to someone's house that I don't know and sit down. And maybe that's just me and my generation.
I think a few things. One is there is a massive just societal shift that's happening here. And a lot of that's because of technology. So we thought social networks were the end all to be all to connect everyone. But what we're seeing is they're not. It's like, you know, someone with 5,000 friends on Facebook but then is eating alone. It's like, how rich of a life are they living? And these, I would call them almost social 3.0. So these online, offline things like Uber and Airbnb and Feastly. I mean, if you look at, first off, what's going on, these are all things we have to do. We all need to sleep somewhere. We all need to move somewhere. And we all need to eat. They're essential services.
And there had been traditional vehicles for that.
That's
taxi cabs or car services that you called on a telephone.
Right.
Restaurants that you ate out at or caterers.
Or Paladors or anything like that, other places.
Right.
And I'd ask you, you know, when you travel, probably tell me about some of those best food meals you've had. I'm assuming at least one of them happened in someone's home, and maybe you didn't know them.
Actually not, but sorry.
That's crazy. Well, if you hear a lot of
people... I'm a restaurant guy. So you know, I travel, I make plans, and I make reservations.
Totally. I mean, for me, those are... If you watch Anthony Bourdain, where is his best experience?
I don't watch
happening?
Anthony Bourdain. But I don't... But it's stage. That's TV. Whatever. I get your point. But Anthony Bourdain... I mean, there's a production company called 0.0.
Okay,
that
the point
every
is he does those then because there's something about them that feels... right for TV, and at least when I see him interacting, there seems to be something very authentic there. And I think when you travel, that's one of the big things that you're looking for, is that authenticity. And when you're even here in the U.S., you know, you can bring the world to you. So, for example, we have food that you can't find even in New York. So food from Macau. Have you ever had food in Macau? Do you even know? I don't even know where to get food from Macau.
No, the closest I would say was when Zach was playing around at Fatty. He was kind of doing pan, whatever you want to call it.
Or, you know, just like regional foods from Malaysia or the Philippines.
Right.
You know, we have one woman who does this amazing Filipino meal, and it's all on banana leaves. Everything's communal. You only eat with your hand because that's the style in the Philippines. And the flavors, everything. You can't find that anywhere really here in the U.S.,
Or she does that here in New York.
She does that here in New York, and actually she's actually making her entire living as a chef on our platform. She'll probably pull in around $60,000. It's called Salo, and you can find it at eatfeastly.com/Salo.
She's in Queens?
She's actually in Brooklyn.
Okay.
She was in Queens, but now she's going to every state. So 50 states in 50 weeks. All over the country, just making these Filipino meals.
It's interesting, because tonight when I leave this, as soon as we get done this, not your interview, but the show at 5, I'm going over to the Altman building. There's a Philippine, the Pulutan. There's a cook-off, the contest. Feature Philippine Chamber of Commerce, come American chefs and Philippine pets, doing this like mashup thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so I look at this as really an empowerment platform. So to say, I understand your trajectory. You went through a very traditional trajectory to get where you are. My thing is that I'm not always one to follow the normal systems and say, hey, there's a better way. We all know that working in a restaurant is not always the easiest job. It's not always the nicest environment. You don't get paid that well.
No,
and,
it sucks,
and
actually.
Essentially,
it sucks,
you're
sucks,
not
sucks.
Doing the thing that you wanted to do when you went to culinary school or joined it, which is like make your food. You know, there's both a self-expression in that and a nurturing in that that doesn't happen. And so why is that? Why hasn't that changed? A lot of times what I've seen from chefs that do try to break out is that the chefs that are above them say, hey, you think you're good enough? You're not good enough. Get back in here and, you know, cut those tomatoes more.
And they've got to deal with negotiating commercial leases, hiring people, getting staff, getting insurance, hoping the reviewers like them. I mean, there's a million balls in the air.
That's the other thing, right? Most restaurants fail. It's very expensive. Yeah. It's very time-consuming. And so we're kind of flipping it all, which is saying, hey, number one, you can do this without any money at all. Number two, you can just do this without, regardless of what anyone tells you. Your failure rate is not based on all this investment that you're making. So we have people who've used this to test out restaurant concept.
Well, it's funny. You know David Santos Loro? You know the restaurant Loro in the Village?
Okay.
Great restaurant in the Village on 10th Street. Used to be Bar Blanc. David's a cool guy. New York resume. In between gigs, he was kind of frustrated because the career of a chef, I mean, this is to your point. The career of a chef... Some guys do really well. It's just it works really smoothly. They go from job A to job B to job C to becoming a restaurateur. The reviewers praise them. The customers come. And next thing you know, they've got multiple restaurants and they're driving a Bentley. For a lot of chefs, it doesn't work that way. It's kind of tough. In between gigs, you get screwed up. You have a gig where it wasn't your fault. The ownership was shaky. Or whatever. There's so many balls that can go wrong. So David, in between a couple of gigs that didn't go the way he wanted them to, that had nothing to do with him, started to do just little private parties in his place in Roosevelt Island.
Yeah,
Did them on social media, advertising, sold them out 25, 30 people, and ended up getting the money, raising the money to Loro from that.
That's awesome. I love that. I mean, that's an epic story. Those are the stories that have happened that we love. And, you know, I don't think that the traditional restaurant's not going anywhere. We're just saying there's a space for a new type of dining, a more connected dining. I think that when you're sitting in a New York restaurant, you're 2 inches away from somebody, and all you're trying to do is not interact with them, it feels weird. It doesn't feel like a normal thing that would happen in any other circumstance. As well as not even knowing, you know, the cook and their story. Why are they making it? Why is it special? You know, I think when you have context behind your food, it makes it more meaningful.
So how many in New York, how many chefs do you have working that you're connecting with? So I kept scrolling down the site and it just kept going. There was the guy that there was that couple that's doing the Italian stuff. So it was seafood Italian, Southern Italian, homemade pasta.
Yeah, that guy, I think he was at Per Se. So, you know, you're seeing these sous chefs or just line cooks from these really nice places saying, hey, you know what? I can do this on my own now. And that's what we want. And we want to be this empowerment platform to let these people be a catalyst and kind of take a different route.
The site's Feastly, F-E-A-S-T-L-Y. You know, what do I know? I mean, it's, to your point, the models have so shifted so quickly in the last 10 years, 5 years even, because of social media, because of different cultural tastes. I mean, look what YouTube did to the music business.
You had That's right.
I was in a wing place on Clinton Street, and there was some kid that I'd never heard of. What's the, Murdley or something. Anyway, nobody knew who this kid was 6 months ago.
Right.
And he did some crazy, like really kind of a ghetto YouTube. He kind of had a neighborhood Brooklyn feel to it. He's a Jamaican kid from Miami that lives in Flatbush. Blew up with this little dad, Bobby Shmurda. That's his name.
Okay.
This guy played the Barclays Center. No one knew who this kid was 6 months ago. He got a record deal this summer and he played the Barclays Center all because of YouTube. So who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, so look what Airbnb is like. How many $1 billion now?
It's billions and billions of dollars.
Billions and billions. And what Uber's doing to that
also
category.
$18 billion category right there. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is fundamentally changing the way that I think people are looking at eating and the way chefs can look about their career in general.
Continued success, man. Great idea.
Thank you.
I mean, it's your world now.
It's eatfeastly.com.
Eatfeastly.com, F-E-A-S-T-L-Y. Google it, see what it thinks. If it's in your town, try it out. If you're in Manhattan, you got a bazillion choices. Thanks so much, Noah Koresh, for coming on. Continued success, man.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. It's been great.
We'll
be back after a quick break, and we got to find, I think someone's got a weed whacker or a blowed thing outside. We've got to shut that off. All right, whatever that is. I haven't heard that yet. Be back in just a second.
I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, bingo. Hi, Steve Jenkins. I remember when Steve Jenkins used to stack cheese at Fairway. He was the guy. All right. Welcome back. Last episode here, we have Josh Bloom, who is one of the creators of a line of simple syrups called Purely Simple. Tell me the story from the beginning, why this came to be. How did you see this? There was a need for this.
That's a good question.
Sorry, I hate to lead off with good questions.
Yeah, that's your job. Well, it seemed there's this whole cocktail renaissance going on.
Yep.
Where I guess we're fully immersed in it, and there's a huge do-it-yourself market. My partner, he's run bars and restaurants for about 25 years, and he's been making these syrups on his own. He's got like 30, 40 recipes, you know, ready to go. And we're sitting there looking at it, and it's like, why wouldn't someone want this ready to go? Why would a professional not want it ready to go? Especially the more complicated ones, like our habanero, for instance. That's not something you want your sous chefs messing with all the time. So a consistent product that's ready to go for both, you know, professional use and home use, we thought was pretty much could be a home run.
Because in lockstep with the artisan cocktail movement, we've just seen a vast improvement in on the spirit end. Mm-hmm. I mean, like Plymouth was just reinvented itself mm-hmm. on the American dark whiskey end. And then suddenly with that came bitters and vermouths, all the pieces that you need, yeah. even
how
down to like
how
custom
many new
ice
bitter
machines.
Companies are
right,
there?
Crazy. Like you go out to these little stores and there's guys making bitters in Brooklyn, and yet no one had done this in the flavored syrup category.
There are a couple guys out there, right. but we felt that if we came through with a 100% organic product that looks like it's ready to be put on a bar and sit on the bar right alongside the bitters and is a tool for bartenders to use. Whereas I think a lot of the other competitors make good products, but I haven't seen anyone that's, you know, 100% organic. And that where the bottle really looks ready to go, you know, open it up, pop the top, put in a speed pour and you're ready to go.
Are you selling the public at all?
Yeah, well, I mean, on our website, we do have e-commerce, okay. but we are mostly a wholesaler.
Primarily, you're a wholesaler to restaurants.
For sure.
And your point about the sous chef thing is right, because at the end of the day, if you're the mixologist or bartender, whatever you want to call them, and you come up with a recipe for a drink, and you have like a habanero simple syrup, one day it's perfect. A week and a half later, somebody else made it, and it's way too hot. A week and a half later, somebody else made it, and it's like flat. So what you're doing is sort of leveling that playing field and saying, no, you. This is what we're going to do.
And it's right, and especially when you get into like things like herbs or vanillas and things like that. With the herbs, we're playing with the basil right now. It's not in our current line. But, you know, every batch of basil you buy is different.
Yeah.
Some are mintier and you know, and some are more, you know, basil forward. So it's really a trick of creating, you know, taking our stove recipe and creating something that's more scalable and consistent every single time.
So how do you do it? That's my big question. As I was thinking about how, putting my chef's hat on, mm-hmm. how you get those flavors in. I mean, simple syrups are ostensibly 50-50 water sugar.
Yeah, that's what like, these are. Bartender simples, one-to-one.
Bartender simples, one-to-one. And in restaurant world, same thing, one-to-one. We say mm-hmm. simple syrup, it means something. How do you get the flavors in? I know it depends on whether you're talking about a habanero or an herb or a ginger, but explain to me how this works and where it's being done. I'm curious. And you can pass anything you want for me to taste.
I'm working on that right
Thank
now
you.
Here. Well,
hard to drink and talk at the same time.
We're
going right
to make what we're doing right here is we're going to go through the whole line, and we're just going to make Italian sodas out of it. It's
right,
the simplest
right.
so way to
seltzer
taste
water, Right, seltzer water and flavor.
Yeah. So here you go right now. The first one is the grapefruit. There you go. Right, so through the process. So, you know, we make our own, you know, home recipes, which we have a bunch of. And then once you start getting into production for usage out in the market, you start having issues like, you know, you have to worry about pH balance and things like that, which as a restaurant or bar, you're it's not your concern. It's not something that's sitting and, you know, microbes growing and stuff like that. So what we do is we work with the food scientist who comes in and helps us take our recipes and get them to scale versions. And it's really that simple. And when it comes down to each flavor, there is actually a different process for each flavor. Some of these flavors are made more like a tea where you make the hot, simple base, you know, and then you would drop in the flavoring and let it sit for however long is necessary. And others, you really cook it into it. But like, you know, like, grapefruit, you don't want to cook grapefruit.
Right, grapefruit I'm thinking would be challenging. But you could use the juice. Mm-hmm. You could take the esters off of the skin. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a bunch of different ways that we get grapefruit flavor in kitchens. How, if you don't mind me asking proprietary questions, how do you go about it with grapefruit?
I mean, a simple answer is we're using beautiful, fresh California pink grapefruits.
And we should say that the facility that makes this is in California.
It is, correct. We're made in Aurora, California, right outside of Sacramento. Half the company is here and half the company is out in San Francisco.
The second one you've poured is ginger.
That is ginger. How do we do that? We use organic Hawaiian ginger root, and that's basically the same process. The ginger you don't really want to cook too much. It's very, more similar to what the grapefruit is, where it's an after. As it's cooling a little bit, it gets brought in.
How many years ago did you start this?
We launched 3 weeks ago. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So... We're like newer than new.
We are newer than new, and we're very proud to be.
How do you get distribution?
Organic.
I mean, it's like, so you have this great idea, you have a product line that so far I'm digging it. How do you get from idea stage to in restaurants?
It's been a long road. We've been working at this for about a year and a half.
Brokers, distributors, go direct.
Kind of pound
knock
the pavement,
on doorbells.
Knock on doors, and you meet the right people. And right now, we just got distribution here in New York through Gotham Artisanal. you know, they're very good. They represent almost every bitter that's out there, and some elixirs and other syrups as well. And so we're very proud to be a part of that portfolio.
What were you doing before this, 3 weeks in the business? I mean, you're a drummer in a band?
Yeah, I mean, my background is in music. Good question again. My background is in music. I ran a music festival for years in Telluride, Colorado, which is actually where I met my partner David, San Francisco now.
Right.
And that's pretty much where the genesis of this happened, was in Colorado.
Gotcha. It's funny. 3 weeks in. So where would we find, for consumers, if they went to a website, and I know you're so new that this is like, the answer might change by the time they listen to this, or you get a better idea. But for consumers, they go to your website, which is?
www.purelysyrup.com.
And it's all organic.
It is all organic. That's correct.
And then they just click on the box, do a PayPal thing, and you ship it to them.
That is correct.
Okay.
Pretty much. I mean, as simple as that.
And in New York, so distribution, whose restaurants, where have you penetrated so far? Because, I mean, the cocktail thing is so crazy. I think Pete Wells actually sort of made fun of it a few weeks ago in one of his reviews where, you know, if he goes, I mean, it was Clover Club and PDT and Death
only.
And Company and Employees Only, and we went to all of them, Pegu, and that was a niche. And then it sort of got to the point where now all the restaurants in the world have a cocktail program and a signature cocktail, to the point where Wells is like, I'm so tired of this, I'm so sick of this, because while some of them are really good, a lot of them kind of suck. I mean, what Bryce and Eamon are doing up at Bettany's maybe on one level, and then you go to some other place and they're just like,
they're making some beautiful stuff up
there.
They're
doing some seriously sick stuff.
I had the pleasure of being over there. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm thinking these guys would be like a natural for you.
Yes and no, you know. Going into this, it goes against their ethos. You know, going into this, those A++ restaurants where had the insane bar program with, you know, famous mixologists and all of that. This goes against what they are doing on paper. We have actually found some traction with the habanero specifically.
I'm drinking vanilla.
You got the vanilla right now. That is Madagascar vanilla beans and vanilla powder from Papua New Guinea.
That's how
you get those.
No, this is like, I mean,
that's a cream soda.
This is totally a cream soda. I grew up in Philly. Cream soda was like one of the things we drank. Mm-hmm. I love cream soda.
My son loves that. Because I was like, we make cream soda? Come on.
How old is your son?
He's 12.
I knew I had the same taste as 12-year-olds. I knew. My kid eats Lucky Charms, and he's 22. He eats Lucky Charms, and then he doesn't finish the milk. And I tell him, save me the milk, dude. And I drink his, I know this sounds gross, but it's delicious. It's like Lucky Charm milk. I think that Christina Tosi, it's like Captain Crunch milk, man. The girl at Sambar does this, right?
Yeah.
She makes a dessert. She makes like a pudding with Captain Crunch milk. Brilliant.
Wow.
So anyway, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Who are you selling it to? Were you finding traction?
So right now, we just got the distribution. So right now we're going to be pounding the pavement pretty hard so we can get it out through Gotham, but pre-distribution, we're in Cafe Mogador in Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the habanero in there. You could find us at Moonlight Mile in Greenpoint, which is an American whiskey bar. Phenomenal. Go see Gary over there. Really, really fine stuff. I think they have over 100 different American whiskeys in there. Fun place. That's a place where they're making all their own syrups. You know, back to why the habanero is having traction. No one wants to mess around with habaneros.
I was going to say.
And jalapenos in their kitchen, and this is a very consistent product. So speaking of that, I'm going to give you the coup de grace to me, which is the habanero. And what you'll find is it's actually roasted jalapenos and habanero in there. So front heat and a back heat. And it will not blow your palate out. However much you drink, tongue-tied, you'll feel it. But it's not.
You can actually smell it. It actually still has a nose and a perfume that's identifiable. So what are they doing with this when you're selling it to them? What are the guys doing at Mogador?
At Mogador, they are doing a mezcal margarita, which is what we recommend doing. So basically, you'd make a margarita and you'd replace a Cointreau or a triple sec with our syrup, because that's the sweet component for margarita. And it is, I must admit,
it's
mine.
This is really good.
Spicy soda.
Yeah, no, this must have been... How much tweaking did it take before you got this right? And how do you get it right? Because how do you... Because, I mean, one of the things, as a chef playing with food all the time, mm-hmm. like my whole life, you can never tell how hot a pepper is going to be. Like, one pepper to the next. Like, even on the same plant, I've had them where, like, the same size, the same pepper, mm-hmm. the same exposure to sun, and, like, one was twice as hot as the other. How do you figure that out? How do you balance out that whole thing?
Well, it's really tricky. And I think
that's why I guess the food scientists get involved.
Yeah, it's exactly where it comes in. So for the habanero specifically, you know, we'll use a habanero powder. which makes up that difference. It is completely consistent. It's organic, and it is made from the habanero. The jalapenos we use in batches. You know, the bigger the batch, the more consistent it can be, is my guess with all of that. You know, when we were playing with this at home, we were using all, you know, whole chilies.
And how'd you get the flavor? So I want to know how you made this one. So how do you get, so you have the powder on one hand, powder's going into the syrup at the end?
Middle to end, as it's cooling.
Okay, the fresh habanero, how's that happen?
At the same time. So you'd make a mash, basically, of all the peppers, and then you would bring it into the base sugar water.
Let it sit for... No heat.
No, yeah, you once the mixture comes off the heat, it can go in.
Okay.
Because you just don't want to cook it. Although we're not boiling the sugar ever.
Because the heat will draw flavor out. So if the ingredients go in into a hot syrup, it's going to sort of extract the flavor.
And then we use, you know, at the scale level, we use a little bit of xanthan gum, which most five-star kitchens use.
As a stabilizer.
And a million things. To get that real nice syrupy consistency out of it.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I'd go in Wiley's Kitchen or some of these modern geeky kitchens and look at the shelves, and I'm like, where the F am I? You know, when I was a chef, it was like, you know, nutmeg.
First time
salt.
You saw the word guar gum, you're
that? And words I don't even know what they are. You know, try this, poly that. I'm like, and that's found its way. I mean, a lot of what informs sort of modern molecular cooking is the in what had been considered industrial ingredients that have found their way into like small.
Yeah, I'm amazed when this molecular stuff, when someone really just knocks it out of the park. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, well, it's something you never had before.
Wiley.
Wiley, Grant. I mean, there's only a few of them. I've never had France food, unfortunately, because you couldn't get in or whatever. Right. All right, so how many flavors now?
We have five flavors. One is a classic, which is unflavored. But we've got grapefruit, we've got vanilla bean, we've got ginger root, and the habanero.
I had them all, and they're all easily identifiable as such. I mean, which is not that I've got a great palate, but it's like obvious what you're doing. This has like more nose than the other. The vanilla was great. That was like cream soda thing was cool. You going to expand the line? What are you thinking of next?
Definitely. I mean, we're looking at a couple more herbal type stuff, like the basil.
Rosemary,
lavender, we're discussing. We want to get a hazelnut. We really want to penetrate into the coffee shops as well. We believe there's a big market for really nice syrups in coffee shops. Right here. Perfect story. You go into a coffee shop. It's farm-to-cup coffee, and they're pumping in like some water, like some sugar water that you have no idea. It's chemicals, this, that, and the other. So we'd love to come in and make a play at that and say, you know, here's
That's an interesting space to be. I never thought about that. Yeah. Smart. That's where there's guys like you.
Let me try.
Good for you. All right. Give me the website again so people can get to know what the name is.
www.purelysyrup.com.
And I think there'd be a retail end of this. I mean, I could see you guys on...
That's
like,
a play.
Not necessarily in Safeways or Kroger's instantly, but in all of... When you think of Brooklyn Larder and Court Street Grocers and all of these
Union
little Fairway,
Market,
Union
guys.
Market, all those places where they've got shelf space for...
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to go there too?
Yeah.
All right.
For sure. For sure. I mean, that's the move. I think we strongly believe that one plays off the other. You see it at the bar, you'll want it in the store.
Yeah, I could just see making... I mean, I drink a lot of water by day, but then I like to drink flavored stuff, and you can't drink booze forever. I mean, I could just see this as just being a great, fun thing to drink at night.
Mm-hmm.
In between, like, when you get bored of water, I'm not a big flavored tea or soda guy. I mean, what you're calling Italian sodas. So you have mineral water, you have a nice, clean, neutral, bubbling water, and this is a flavoring, and...
Yeah, like a fever tree or something like that.
Yeah, talking about another guys that changed the game and
exactly.
All those quinines and gingers and all that stuff. Exactly. Good luck, Josh.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I'm not going to ask you for the name of the band because it's really hard to pronounce it in Spanish. It means something really funny. But Josh Bloom, Purely Simple Syrup. You can find him on the web. Hopefully you can find him in some restaurants you're going to soon. I just say buy this stuff as a gift and give it away for Christmas with a little sparkling water. It's delicious. Hey, everybody, have a great Thanksgiving. Good luck cooking your turkey. Just remember that the breast won't cook at the same time as the thighs and the legs. So if you want to cook them together, enjoy those thighs and legs and just get a lot of gravy on those breasts because it's totally overcooked, or break them apart like chefs do. Have a great Thanksgiving. We're off next week. We'll be back the week after. See you then. Take care. Signing off for my Calico's Food Talk this week. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.